obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, everybody. My name is Danny, and I'm an alcoholic. That's the good news. Wow, is it great to be here. I love coming to this roundup, and I have so many people to thank that could be the whole damn talk. I mean, first of all, thank you, Mike Yerko. I'm breaking his anonymity because he breaks mine regularly. I love Mike. I love his dedication to music, to the musicians in this fellowship, and the celebration of music and sobriety together. It seems to go hand in hand. Back there, my friend in the multicolored shirt, Dave. I love you, Dave. I see him wherever I go. He's there. This is all about service. AA is all about service. And boy, it takes a lot of service to put this thing on. And I love this convention. I have a little history with this convention. Diane C., who I met 16 years ago, she asked me to bring a little band down here to play your Friday night dance. That's when my love affair with the Roundup began. And 16 years ago, I brought a band down. We called it the Boiled Owls. Right out of the big book, and it was three sober friends of mine, and we went on to do some, you know, we'd play some conventions and stuff like that, and it was just so easy for me. It was another gift of sobriety. You know, being that this is a musician's meeting, I got to talk about music a lot, so I'm going to do a little bit of a different pitch today, because a lot of you people just heard me over at that Freedom Festival a couple of weeks ago in Long Beach, so you can leave now. But I'll try to change it up a little bit, and I want to thank my friend Doug for coming by, one of my sponsors. I love Doug, and my wife is here with me, of course, and Teresa I haven't seen in many years. I just love Teresa. And then my friend George came out from New York. We were both sponsored by a fellow by the name of Scott Redman, you know, and George just celebrated 21 years. He came out to spend some time with us and take a cake with him and celebrate Scott, you know. So, man, I don't know where to begin. There's just so much going on in my head right now. The other speakers, I miss Charlie. I got to go buy the tape from Charlie, but I hear he was sensational. Jennifer, kill me. Jennifer's just one of the funniest women I've ever heard in my life. And what a message she had, you know. So I hope you got laughed out because mine ain't that funny. Mine was kind of sad. A lot of cheating, lying, throwing up and all that stuff, you know, but mine was just sad, like, when's he going to get done with this stuff, you know? But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got here with a lot of big problems, and I had no solutions. I just poured alcohol on my problems. That's all I did. And thank God, I mean, there's only one person happier than I am that I'm sober, and that's my wife. Stand up. We've been married, this Thanksgiving will be 46 years. She ain't right. I would have left way long time ago, but 46 years, you know, and I'm glad she hung it out, you know, because some of those years were good, some were bad, some got rained out, and some should have never been scheduled, you know. Alcoholism isn't a pretty thing. It's not a pretty thing, and thank God for Bill and Bob, you know. Thank God that these two guys just met up and gave us a solution to the 20th century. Before 1935, they said to us, you're an alcoholic and there's really nothing we can do for you. You're going to die you'll have a horrible life and die a horrible death. And there's nothing we can do for you. Isn't that sad? I really believe that when history looks back at the 20th century, that the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous will be right at the top. So I missed telling you one thing. My sobriety date is January the 2nd, 1991. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who doesn't have a sponsor. I just found out recently my sponsor doesn't have a sponsor anymore. And it's interesting, but I really believe in sponsorship. I really believe in one drunk talking to another. I found solutions to my problems in a very beneficial way. I mean, as you can, most of you know that I'm a drummer. That's my other home right there behind those noisy things. But, you know, like for me to find solutions to problems that were so big that they took me out for 28 years and I almost ruined my life over a beverage, you know. And that's what we do. That's what we do in alcoholism. Let me get back to the beginning here, and I'll try to wrap this stuff up so we can have some fun playing some music and get some people up and what have you. But when I was a kid, I mean, I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, and my dad was a drummer, so that's the drumming thing came real easy to me. They gave me a snare drum when I was 1 year old. I took a stick, I poked it through both heads, they took it away from me. I had it for about 15 minutes. Then when I was 3 years old, they'd sit me down on the rug with a pair of drumsticks, and at night when they picked me up to go to bed, I'd leave a hole in the rug wherever I sat. You know, I'd just sit there and tap away. And when I was 5 years old, they enrolled me in a boys' band association. When I was 7 years old, I was playing with the kids. By the time I was 13, I'd played every drum book written. I'd played in little orchestras, little bands. I had a rock and roll band. I had a dance band. And I'd had my first drink. You know, I was working gigs at the Elks Lounge and the Moose Club and the AF of M and, you know, or AMVETS and all of those places, you know. So, and my family was deeply, deeply immersed in the church, not just churchgoers. My mom was a church secretary, my father a deacon, my grandfather an elder, my sister, my brother, and my grandmother all sang in the church choir. Best I could do was steal money out of the collection plate. I had 13 years of perfect attendance. Now, when you get home Saturday night from a gig at the Elks Club or something, you get home at 3:30 in the morning, my mom would come in and she'd kick the bed. Get up, you're going to church, damn it. I said, isn't that a mixed message, Mom? I would get up and go to church, you know, Sunday school and church. So what happened for me is I had no alcoholism in my family, but my granddad, maybe 3 or 4 times a year, between Sunday school and church was a 15-minute window where he could run down to the American Legion home and have a shot and a beer. And when and if he did that, my job was to sit in the church with him and keep him awake, you know. I could just see him starting to nod off. And as soon as he'd go, the choir loft would just come to life and they'd say, wake him up, wake him up. I just wanted to be him. You know, I didn't drink, he didn't drink like anything that I knew later on. I mean, there was no drinking, but I just loved that he could miss church by having a shooter and a beer, you know. So anyway, and my dad, I used to buy him a bottle of Drambuie or something if I was in Europe, and he didn't drink. You know, I'd come home 5 years later, and the thing was open, and it's still there in the bar, so I'd finish it for him, of course. But, you know, I grew up in one of those places back there where it was all Bethlehem steel workers or anthracite coal mines. And these guys were tavern drinkers. They came home from work, and if you had 50 cents in your pocket, you could get a shot of a Christian Brothers brandy and a short beer. If you had another 15 cents in your pocket, they'd give you a slice of hot bologna and a hard-boiled egg pickled in red beet juice. Yeah. Man, after that, you had enough gas to fly to Cleveland, but... But for $5, you could lose your car. And I did on many occasions. That's the way I learned how to drink, you know, and it was good. Alcohol worked for me for a very, very long time. I got sober, I was 47. So I really hung on to my right to throw up in the morning, you know. A few days, I'm going to be 69 years old. And I never expected to live that long. I would have taken better care of my body if I did, you know. But, you know, alcohol worked for me for a very long time. And when I was a fun kid. I was always a little different because of the music thing. That little bit of difference was taken away with my first drink. Every time I put that drink on me, I wasn't different anymore. I was better. And I had that much fun in the 11th grade that they asked me to stay back a year and show the kids coming up behind me how to have that much fun before leaving the 11th grade, which I did gladly. Finally, I was getting out of high school finally, and it was Vietnam, so they were about to draft me. And I'd kind of done pretty well in music throughout school, and the boys band and my school band and the school and the town band and all of this stuff. I had made a little name for myself in my area. And I heard that you could get out of carrying a gun and going to Vietnam if you could get into one of the Navy School of Music, which I did. I joined the Navy in 1962, and I went to Washington, D.C., had an audition. And I got into this Navy School of Music program. It was really great. It was really great. And meanwhile, you know, like, alcohol isn't even a part of my life yet. It really isn't. I'm just having it once in a great while. And I come from a very sheltered town. I mean, there was no drugs. There was no drugs. I didn't hear about drugs till I was like 19, 20 years old or something like that, halfway through my hitch in the Navy. I was sheltered. So anyway, I'm in the Navy band, and they take some cream of the crop kids from the music school, and they dress us up and they put us on a ship and send us to South America to promote goodwill. Now, you take a 19-year-old kid in a white uniform, put him out to sea for a couple of weeks, then cut him loose in a strange country, say, go promote goodwill. We did our share of that. And I hear my alcohol just... I went from that shot in the beer to a little bit of vino tinto and some vino rojo and some pisco sours, you know. Like, I'm expanding my horizons. I'm having a little more fun with alcohol while it's still working. And, you know, I can't believe that I was in South America. I was in Brazil and Chile and Argentina, all of those countries. That's where that band went, to South America. I forgot to tell you that. But we were in South America, and... I didn't even know what marijuana or cocaine, any of those things were. I could have got here a lot earlier if I just would have had that simple information at my... But anyway, I didn't know, and I just expanded my horizon with alcohol, and things were going really good. The last job I had was in the Admiral of the Sixth Fleet had a band on his ship in the south of France. So here I am in the Admiral of the Sixth Fleet ship, and we'd get up in the morning. So it was a light cruiser or something like that. I was terrible with any of the Navy stuff, you know. Sorry. But I think it was at least I didn't call it a boat, you know. But in the morning, we'd get up to the back of the boat there, and we'd play the Star Spangled Banner and raise the flag, you know. And there were tourists that lived in the hotels around where we were anchored there, and they used to say to the Admiral, hey, can you guys not make that racket in the morning? So the Admiral says, tell you what, guys, when we're in home port, which is a lot of times, he said, you don't have to play colors. You can have what they call 96-hour liberty. So it was just 4 days, so I had an apartment in Nice, France, had civilian clothing, I was working the jazz clubs, and I'd show up to the ship once every 4 days, and I'd buy a carton of cigarettes was $1, and a bottle of Chivas Regal 12-year-old was $3. And then I'd go back to my apartment on the French Riviera, and I'd drink some Chateau Neuf du Pape and some Nuit Saint-Georges, and I was learning how to drink like a gentleman. Well, I met my wife over there. She's from south of France. She didn't even know I was in the Navy at first, you know. She's like, what's this guy all about? You know, it was great stuff. And alcohol, again, it worked for me for a very long time. So got my hitch was done. I spent 4 years, 1 month, 17 days, 11 hours and 39 minutes in the Navy. But when I got out, by then my wife, my girlfriend at the time, I said, well, let's take this a little further. Why don't you come over to the States and let's see what happens? And we got married. So November 26, 1966, we got married. And Thanksgiving, yeah. And went to New York to start my career. So now I'm in New York, and I meet all my heroes. And my heroes are the guys that I listen to on records, and they had needles hanging out of their arms. I mean, just so drunk they could hardly stand up. It was really a disillusion to me that they could make that kind of music. And I said, well, if that's what you have to make that kind of music, where do I go to get some? So I did a little outside issues. I started to fool around with the same stuff that my heroes fooled around with because I thought it would make me a better player. The first job I had in New York was a job at a famous old jazz club in New York that didn't pay a lot of money, but you got a lot of visibility by working at this club. So through that visibility of me playing with the heroes, my masters, pretty soon the better work started coming my way, and the better work was the recording work. And in the 60s, you know, they'd start 9 o'clock in the morning with a TV commercial. Now you're recording 60 seconds worth of music, so you're only there for 30, 40 minutes maybe. So you could book one at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. You're never there for more than maybe sometimes 45, 50 minutes, but you still got time to get to the next job, which is, you know, a couple hundred yards away in New York City. They were all the studios were in the same. So we'd get to work at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'd just get off work at 3:30 in the morning at the jazz club. So I'd get home, and I'd smoke a couple of joints, take a couple of Valium, drink a half a bottle of whatever, try to get to sleep because I had to get up in the morning and get to this job that I was going to. And in those days, they were giving us this, we called it marching powder. And this stuff, it was like some false energy, if you know what I mean. I don't mean to get off the track here, but this is the way it was. And so we'd have a couple of honks of that stuff and go right to work again. And all we were doing was trying to stay awake. That's really what we weren't trying to get high. It was in 1967, they were telling us that cocaine wasn't addictive. It was nature's way of letting you know you're making too much damn money. I'm telling you, we weren't getting high. We were staying awake. And we'd go to work, and the record company guys or the advertising agency guys would bring us this stuff. And they'd say, now, here's everything you guys need. Now, give us the magic. And we did. Some of those records that we made in the 60s are still being played on the radio today. And we were high as big dogs. So anyway, that went on for quite a while, and it was, you know, quite a breakneck pace to keep that thing going. And then this guy from England came to town. He was like a major guy in the pop world. And he wanted to make a record with some New York musicians. And he set up little clandestine kind of auditions. So you didn't really know that it was an audition, but you were called into some place, and I met this guy. And most of the drummers got the same audition that I did. And he just liked me and hired me for a project. So now I say to myself, wow, I've scored here. This is really good. It doesn't get any better than this. This guy was major. Did the record. The record came out, went right to number one a couple of months after the record is out. And now my career in New York is really like I'm first call for any of the good work that's going on. They call me first. And my career is going really, really well. A couple of months, the record's still on the top of the charts, and this guy calls me from England. He says, hey, would you and your wife like to take a little vacation? Just hang out, and he had a place in Scotland at the time, and I said, absolutely. So we go over, and we're hanging out in Scotland, figure we'll go down to see my wife's family and niece and everything. We're in Europe, so just take a break. And while we're there, he says, you know, I'd like to, I miss my old band. He just left one of the biggest bands of all times, and he said, would you like to form a band? Now, of course, I see the biggest band of all times. I see the way I used to work 18-hour days and trying to get all that stuff I was doing, you know, and I said, this ain't right, and I know that this will take care of us financially the rest of our lives. Count me in. So I made my first mistake. If you're new out there and you have an alcoholic brain, don't use it till we get a chance to change that for you, okay? So I didn't know that I even had an alcoholic brain at the time, but I made this agreement with this guy to leave New York, leave my position in that city, and move over there and join a band with him on a hippie handshake, which for the time was pretty common. It was pretty common. So the hippie handshake, boom. Get over there, form this band, we record, we tour. Everything is going great. I mean, we're selling out tours of Europe. We're doing all of this great stuff. And the agreement was that we were all part owners of the band. Well, that part owner stuff just never happened. He had some legal problems, but there were a lot of problems anyway, but it never happened. And the trickle-down effect, the old Reagan trickle-down effect, wasn't trickling down. And after a while, it got a little tougher and a little tougher. Guys are coming over to my place at night, and they're just, this is remember, in one of the top bands in the 70s, and we don't have nothing to show for it. So we're complaining. Then I used my alcoholic brain again. And I said, I know how to handle this. I'm just going to leave. Now, I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that one of my major character defects is I'm a retaliator. If you get me, I'm going to get you back. I'll wait, I'll bide my time, but I'm going to get you back. And this guy got me, so I knew I had to get him back. We were leaving to Lagos, Nigeria that night to make his biggest selling record. One of the other guys had just left the band. So I knew that if I left now, I would really hurt him. So I called him up, and I said, that's it. I just can't do this anymore. There was no talk or anything. I just said, I'm out of here. I'm done. Clunk. And that was the end of that conversation. I didn't know it at the time, but that was the day that my alcoholism took on a whole new meaning. I had just given birth to my first resentment. You know, you're going to hear resentment's the number one offender. It has the power to kill us. I'm here to tell you. And you're also going to hear that that resentment is like taking poison and expecting someone else to die. And that's what it is, too. So from that day on, my drinking changed. Every drink that I took was no longer fun. I drank at this guy, my old boss. And I said, I'll show you. I'll kill myself. Slowly. That's the alcoholic brain. So I went about killing myself, and I said to my wife, come on, let's get out of here. I can't do this. Let's go back to California, or back to the States. Didn't want to go to the rat race in New York. We came to California. Figuring that with my reputation, the California music world would say, who are you? Or no, they would say, of course, come in. We need you here. But instead, they said, who the hell are you and who asked for you? Now I got two resentments. So pretty soon, when I don't know what to do with one resentment, but
and anything that he did that I didn't like, I would hold
worse and make it worse. So my wife started working and I started drinking. And it wasn't pretty. The final stages of this disease are really not pretty, as we all know. And I was a nice guy, though. I tried to drink during the day so I could be home for her when she came home from work, you know. And she would find that if she came home a little bit later each night, I'd be blacked out, passed out on the couch, and she wouldn't have to deal with me. So that's the way it was. I drank in a bar, and I couldn't wait till the bar opened up at 10:40 in the morning. Like, 10:40? Who thought of that opening hour, you know? And I couldn't wait to get there to drink with my lower companions, you know. I wanted to have my beers done by noon.
So I would drink while he would play, and then we had a room.
Stoli, that was the way I hid it. And then I'd be home from my wife when she came home from a hard day's work. And so I'd wake up 3:30 in the morning, and I'd say to myself, I did it again. I didn't want to do this. So I'd slither into bed, try not to wake her up, and she'd get up for work at 5:30 in the morning, and I could never figure how a woman made that much noise just getting dressed in the morning. You know, and it was just enough to shoot me that look. Some of you guys have seen that look. And I didn't want to live like that, but I had no solution. I didn't know how not to live like that. So I went to my family doctor, realizing that I had a drinking problem. I said, my family doctor was a guy named Ralph, and he played the string bass. I love doctors that are musicians on the side, so I trust them more. So anyway, I went to Ralph. I said, Ralph, I think I got a problem with alcohol. He said, well, if you truly have a problem with alcohol, there's only one thing that works, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. What else do you got? Come on, I lived in France. I'm a musician. So anyway, I tried acupuncture. Works for a while, maybe 6 months. Then the disease starts talking to you again. You can do it. You can do it. It'll be different this time. You'll respect King Alcohol. You can. Slowly, I started back in. One more attempt, I tried hypnosis. You know, I was really hanging on to my right to get up in the morning and throw up. You know, it was just so sad. I didn't know what to do. It was getting worse and worse and worse. I'm playing golf with a a famous disc jockey that invited me over to this rich guy's club, and I'm broke. I'm feeling like terrible. Here I am from the top of the heap. I'm already down to a low-life bar drinker that has no work, no future, no promise, no nothing except alcohol. And this guy calls me to play golf. He was a fan, and I'm playing golf. And all of a sudden, I start getting these weird chest pains, and I call Ralph up, that doctor friend, and I said, "Hey, Ralph, I'm getting these chest pains." And he said, "Ooh." He knew the way I lived, what I took, drugs, alcohol. He knew the way I lived, and he said, "You know what? You could have a problem here. We're going to go see Dr. Steve. He's a piano player, too." And he said, "We're going to go see Dr. Steve and see if there's a... He's a cardiologist." I went, "Oh, okay." We went to see Dr. Steve. Steve took a look at me. He put me right in the hospital. And I forget what day it was, but... you know, in the hospital, it's called an angiogram, where they squirt some dye in your heart, and they just see if you have a blocked artery and stuff. So before they get you ready for this, though, they give you some... you're awake, but I'm telling you, they could cut your leg off, and you wouldn't give a damn. I mean, they gave me some stuff so good that I didn't ask what it was. That's how good it was. I mean, we're laying there, and I'm laughing, and I'm joking with the doctor, and he said, "Oh, we found a big blockage here. We're going to stick a balloon in your heart now. Don't worry, we got you covered." And as he's saying, "We got you covered," the nurse is saying, "He's going, he's going, he's gone." And I died for a minute. They never told me how long I was gone, but I think God was trying to get my attention to say, "Hey, knucklehead." Anyway, I was out for a little bit. I guess they paddled me back. It was okay, and... it was a little weekend in the hospital as far as I was concerned, but it was successful, and they were sending me home. Now, before I go home, it was our 20th anniversary. We were in the Santa Monica Hospital. Thanksgiving. I just had a near-death experience, and my buddy sent a limo to take us home from the hospital. He had a little limo company, you know. So he sends his car to take us home, and before I leave the hospital, I said to that Dr. Steve, the cardiologist, I said, "Hey, man, what can I do? I just died on this guy's table." He said, "Well, you can never do cocaine again." Great, I don't like that stuff anyway. I said, "What about marijuana? That's a kind of a creative drug. We kind of need that. Musicians need that." He goes, "Well, they found that marijuana speeds up the heart rate." So I said, "Okay, I'll be careful." And, "Well, what about alcohol?" He said, "Well, on the other hand, they found that one glass of white wine each day is really good for the circulation." I went, "Hallelujah." So in the limo on the way home from the hospital, it has a car phone in it, and this is 1986, before the cell phones and stuff, so I had to use the phone, so I called my dope dealer, stopped, and I picked up a little bag of weed. And then I went to Vendome Liquors, and I picked up two bottles of that circulation. I wanted to make sure I had that right, you know. And for the next 4 or 5 years, I had one glass of white wine a day. I had hit off the joint. I ran around Lake Hollywood every morning, and I ate nothing but fish and vegetables, and I hate fish and vegetables. Pretty soon, I'm burning up the treadmill in the doctor's office, and the disease says, "You can do a little more than that. Come on, man. What are you, crazy? You can have a whole joint. You can have a bottle of wine. You can have a cognac after dinner." It was on one more time. And I knew that there was only one thing that was left, and that was Alcoholics Anonymous. So I used to drink with this little comedian buddy of mine up at this bar, and he used to drink red wine, pineapple juice, and coffee. That was his drink. Red wine for the buzz. Pineapple juice to stay healthy, coffee to stay awake, right? Makes sense. So I saw Sandy, and he didn't have the red wine anymore. I said, "What's up?" He said, "Went to that AA thing." I went, "Uh-oh, that's all I got left." So Sandy started taking me to my AA meeting, and I went to the Comedy Store on Sunset Strip. 5:30, they had this meeting. Oh, my God. 5:30, they had this meeting Wednesday afternoon. So I quit drinking. But I didn't quit smoking the herb. You know, I needed that. I'd just smoke one on the way in and have one rolled for the way out. It made the speaker so much funnier, you know. And it's just easy for me to detox. I was really doing vast quantities of alcohol because it was free from a place that I worked. They said, we can't give you what you're worth, so you can have an open bar tab and drink as much as you like. Woo! Thank you, Craig. He got me here a little quicker than I could have. But anyway, you know, like, so I'm taking 30, 60, 90-day chips in this meeting, and I'm high as a big dog. My eyes look like two road maps of Georgia. But I didn't drink. I didn't drink. And so I heard through those 3 months that Alcoholics Anonymous, everything from the neck up is what counts. So I knew I had to try something. And January the 2nd, which is my sobriety date, was my grandmother's birthday, and I thought, what a great time to get sober. Let me just get sober for her and for me, of course. So New Year's Eve, I worked with a band. I had a little, I was using that alcoholic brain again. I had 20 joints rolled up in a cigarette pack. I had a 2-gram vial of blow and a bottle of non-alcoholic champagne. I wasn't drinking, damn it. January 2nd, I licked my wounds and I started going to AA. And I was into the program 29 days. I got sober at the Chandler Lodge, Richard Shirelli. Yeah, Chandler Lodge. It was just great. The women up there took such good care of Flo and Anne Marie and Shirelli. I mean, all of the people just welcomed me. I came in twitching, you know, like we all do. And our San Fernando Valley Convention, that's why I love these conventions, was going on. I was newly sober. I was 29 days sober, I believe. And it was at the old Universal Sheraton, and I was at the spiritual breakfast, not knowing you needed a ticket to get into the damn meeting. And I'm in the hallway about to explode with a resentment, and Jeannie and Anne-Marie and Flo came out. They saw me out there in the state I was in, and they came out to go to the bathroom and took one of the ladies' tickets. They snuck me into the convention, right? So I'm sitting in the back of the room, and right in front of me is a table full of people, and I noticed a guy in that table. He was a guy that I'd see everywhere I went in AA. I liked the way his name was Scott Redman, of course. I asked him that day to be my sponsor. Shit. God damn it.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I asked him to be my sponsor that day, and he said, I'm a little busy right now. I sponsor all the guys. And Nancy told me later that she gave him a shot. She said, you better give this guy a chance because he looks like he really wants it. That was the day that it started happening for me. He said, I'd like you to call me every day for 7 days. If you miss a day, we have to start all over again. He knew what kind of a knucklehead I was going to be. And he said, I want you to get up in the morning and I'd like you to say this prayer. I'm powerless. My life's unmanageable, but I know you'll restore me to sanity, so I'm yours. What I didn't know is he had me working the first 3 steps. So get up in the morning. I'm powerless. My life's unmanageable. I know you're going to restore me to sanity. Today I'm yours. Call Scott. We talk. Now things are going good. I'm not thinking about drinking. I'm not thinking about drugging. I'm going to a lot of meetings now, 3-4 meetings a day sometimes. Things are really great. And then I see some guys that aren't sticking around, and I'm saying, uh-oh. Now we got a problem. If I go out there again, I may never find my way back. So now luckily, I'm
980. Man, all I had to do was follow her.
So I called Scott up and I said, hey, I need to do a 4-step. He said, perfect timing. Come on up. So I come up to Scott's, and here's where the Alcoholics Anonymous miracle begins. When it's one drunk talking to another drunk, pot of coffee, big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's that one drunk talking to another drunk. That's the miracle. That one drunk talking to himself, that doesn't work so good, so kind of stay away from that. But, you know, Scott read me chapter 5 the way we read it at most meetings. He said, stop me if you don't understand something and I'll explain it to you. And we went through that and he got through the A, B's and C's, the 3 pertinent ideas, A, B and C, that God could and would have sought. We don't even have to find him. We just have to seek him. He went on to explain the inventories to me. He says, all right, we read on in chapter 5. That's all we were doing. He wasn't telling me nothing that was new. He was reading out of the book. He said, get some paper out, draw a line across the top, some lines down here, write resentments. He says, do you have any resentments? I said, geez, not that I can think of. I said, well, what about that guy in England that screwed you out of all that money? Oh, yeah, him. All right, put his name down. So I put his name down. And he said, now, what was the cause of the resentment, the next column? Well, he promised me pay for work. I worked. He didn't pay. Good. Write that down. Now, the next column is, how did you having that resentment affect your life? I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, look on the bottom of page 64, and when we have these resentments, it usually affects our self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relationship, or sex. So did it affect your self-esteem? Yeah, I thought I was a loser. Did it affect your pocketbook? Were you listening? Did it affect your ambition? Absolutely. I thought the next band I'm in, I'm going to get screwed too. Did it affect your personal relationships? Well, I couldn't say this guy's name without MF behind it. Did it affect your sex? Everything does. He goes, great, you got a five bagger right there. So here's my first resentment. He said, I was learning so much from this. He said, now here's the good part. Turn the paper over, and on the top, I want you to write, now what is the fault in Denny that if God would come along and remove it, he would no longer have this resentment? I said, wait a minute. Man, I was doing really good till I met this guy. And then I left, and he said, look, we're not taking his inventory. This is your inventory. So I said, look at it from an entirely different angle. Get tough on yourself for once. So I said, well, there's millions of dollars floating around. I'm working on a hippie handshake. I have no agreement in writing. That might make me irresponsible. There you go. There's my first character defect. Then I start using the alcoholic brain again. When I'm irresponsible, it's usually because I'm afraid. Fear of confrontation. And then when I'm in fear of confrontation, I do some more thinking. I know how to solve this. I'll just freeze you right out of my life. Then I go to silent scorn, emotional blackmail, character assassination. Then I'm on a roll. And I had no idea that that's what was going on. And that was the only way that I could nurture a resentment like that for 28 damn years, you know. So anyway, I did all my resentments. I got my fears down. And by the way, this disease, I've found over the years that this disease is really motivated by two main factors, self and fear. That's the whole bottom line right there. Just like love and service, like Dr. Bob says, self and fear are the two motivating factors. When we're not thinking about ourselves, we're thinking about ourselves. And we're driven by 100 forms of fear, fancied or real. That means when we don't have a real one, we'll make one up. So, you know, I did that fear list. I didn't do a very good job on that, I'm sure. You can't do that right away. It takes a little time till this stuff really... And the sexual inventory, it's brilliant. I mean, it just asks these very important questions of alcoholics. Where was selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? Jesus, everywhere. How could I have unjustifiably aroused suspicion, bitterness, or jealousy? My wife knew every time I went on tour or I left the house, if I was going to have a drink, anything was possible. You know, that's what alcohol did to me. So I got those three inventory lists done. And what happened was, I should back up just a little bit. I think one of the best things that happened was when I got up to that appointment to see Scott to learn how to do this inventory stuff. We got on our knees and we took that third step prayer together, which for me dealt with all of that hippie handshake stuff. You know, that third step prayer dealt with all my issues. That's all I needed right there. I mean, the third step prayer was so deep. I can't be, you know, the big book talks about it when we do this, and I do this with every man. Just like Scott and I, we crossed arms, we took the third step. God, I'm offering myself to thee to build with me and do with me thou, as thou wilt. Relieve me the bondage of self, so I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties. What are my difficulties? My difficulties are going to be all these things I'm going to find out in this inventory. Why? So I may bear witness to those I would help of thy love, thy power, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Now we unhooked arms, we got off of our knees. And I stood up and I felt like, wow, that was deeper than the hippie handshake I took. And the big book talks about it. It says when an effort is made, a humble effort is made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. I felt that. I felt I'd never have to take a drink again in the rest of my life. And every time I get off my knee, I only use one knee, I've had knee replacements, but I'll still get down on one to do the third step prayer with a new man. But every time I get off my knee with that new man, I just feel like my nightmare is over. I don't ever have to drink again, you know. So what a brilliant thing that whole process was. I got the same thing happened when I went back to read my fifth step. I went about my inventory, my amends, went back to Pennsylvania to that hometown where I'm from to make amends to some of my family. And the first thing I do when I travel is to call AA and find out where the meeting is, of course. The meeting was in the same church that I stole money from, you know, of course. So I'm at the meeting there, and there's the seven founding fathers, pictures on this little room. It was the nursery room that I was brought as a baby, by the way. And there's my granddad's picture, and I was making amends to him for the way I tended bar at his funeral. My family didn't have bars. We didn't drink even at funerals, but I did. So after the Sunday morning, went to the church service, paid all those quarters. I got the gig of the offerings, you know, the seven tradition. I'd just take them down to the church office. I'd steal a quarter. I'd go across the street, have a smoke and a Coke, and wait for the damn thing to be over. So I had to pay all those quarters back with interest, too. So I did that. We went up to the graveside, up to the cemetery to see my grandparents were there. My dad was there. And I wanted to make amends to them. And I got out of the car and I walked up to that cemetery plot and just wept like a baby. I was just so ashamed of what I had done with this beautiful life that was handed me so beautifully. And I did it over this beverage, you know. I just couldn't imagine. So anyway, I came back to L.A. and I really started doubling up on my efforts in Alcoholics Anonymous. More sponsoring, more commitments, more everything. A couple of years into it, my mom calls me up and she says, the doctors have diagnosed me with a problem. I have an aneurysm in my aorta. They think I've had it for a long time. They're afraid it's going to rupture, and I'm scared. They want to do surgery. I said, well, Mom, if only you were an alcoholic. She said, what do you mean? I mean, you know how we are on our parents. A lot of heartache there. But I said, Alcoholics Anonymous tells me all I have to do to get rid of these fears is to write them down. Yeah, and then what? I said, well, we write them down and ask God to remove them, and immediately we commence to outgrow the fear. Why don't you try doing that, Mom? So she started doing it. So every day she'd write in her journal the things that she were afraid. I'm afraid of surgery. I'm afraid the kids are, I'm afraid I'm going to die. All of these things. She wrote it down, and I talked to her every day, and I got her ready for this surgery. Now this big team of doctors in back east, they canceled the surgery at the last minute and postponed it for 30 days. She went to absolute terror, and I had to give her the best that you guys give me every day. And we got her ready again. I flew home for the surgery, and my sister and I were there. My kid brother couldn't make it. We had the best of the best, and we wheeled her into surgery thinking she'd be fine, and she didn't make it. It was a brutal surgery, and it was just too bad. So next day, we're up at the family house, going through the stuff, getting ready for the funeral, and I opened up her journal that she'd been keeping, and in there, she said how her son and his wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous made the last days of her life so much better than they would have been. Give me a break. Am I overpaid or what, you know? She knew. So that night, I was the last one in the funeral home with my mom, and I had my 5-year medallion, and I put it in her hand, closed her hand, and then closed the coffin. I want to remember where I left that medallion, you know, and remember I don't ever have to go back to that way of life again. And the next morning, we put her next to my dad and her parents, and I stood there a different man. I stood there proud of what I'd allowed you guys to make of me. And That was amazing. It was an amazing period of my life, 5 years sober, and all of this stuff is going on. Now I'm coming home from that adventure, and I realize I got to make amends to that guy in England, and I have to make amends to him without asking for a check. That was the hard part. So, you know, I contacted him. I don't even remember. I might have written him a letter or a quick phone call. But I wasn't quite sure how to do this. It was all new, and it was kind of a situation that I'd had so long in my life. And Dr. Paul helped me through a lot of that stuff. Dr. Paul just really, he sent me to Emmett Fox's Sermon on the Mount. And I'd done inventory work, extensive inventory work. I did the forgiveness prayer that's mentioned in Sermon on the Mount. I tried everything I could to get rid of this because it was killing me. It was absolutely killing me. There's another one that I really miss dearly. Dr. Paul, man, we've had some giants around here, haven't we? We've certainly had some giants, man. I wasn't quite sure whether my amends were made. And I turn on the television one day, and I see that his wife just died from breast cancer. I knew she was sick, but nobody knew she was that sick. So now here's this guy that I couldn't talk to for many, many years. And actually, I had seen them like 4 or 5 years before she passed away. I went to kind of renew our friendship and tell him, see how it was sitting anyway. And she gave us the home phone number, so we'd talk every once in a while. And we were getting along. We were rebuilding the relationship, and then she passed away. And immediately I called him up, and I couldn't believe that I had the compassion in me to, you know, just be there for the guy in another long-term relationship like we were. And we had a great talk, and we got invited into New York.
He was going to pay for that when he got sober.
Go to New York. And we're at the church, and we're ushered in right up to the front of the church. We sat across from the family, and afterwards we had a long talk, and I knew my amends were accepted and understood, you know. So then we went to visit him in England a couple of months later, and we're over there just seeing how he's doing. And he says, well, you know, my daughter's going to do like a little documentary film on the band from the original days when you were in it. We're going to re-release a lot of that music. And immediately I just said, what can I do to help? And so, you know, that wasn't the way I thought about that band for many years. So I gave him some footage I had, some little video from goofing around backstage and stuff. And I'll be damned if they didn't send me a check. I thought, wow.
I had found a much nicer drink.
I see a lot of promo for this thing, and I see the promotions are getting big. And I call my buddy at the record company. I said, why would people buy the same music?
Happened, and the only offers I got were junior colleges and NAIA schools. And it's like if you ever.
And I'd made a deal with God. I said, please. No, not that one. That's another deal. I said, please. You know, I don't care if I ever see another dime from those years as long as I don't have to drink again. That was my deal with God. But now Scott and I had broken up, and I had another sponsor, a fellow by the name of Steve, and I were sponsoring each other. His sponsor had 50-some years of getting a little senile. And so we started sponsoring each other. And I said to Steve, I said, what do you think I should do about this? And he said, why don't you write him a letter? I said, well, because I made this deal with God. And he said, well, you know, got to remember, God's old and he moves slow. So I wrote this letter. And I kind of told my old boss exactly what was explained to me, how I was going to participate, what happened, how it was, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, I told him the whole deal. And I wrote 3 versions of it. So if you're going to do this, don't send the first one. And always read it to your sponsor before you send it, and always say a prayer before you send it. So anyway, I got the draft down to the letter that I felt was right, and I read it to my sponsor, and he said, I think he said what you needed to say. Said a prayer to God. He told me to mail it. I put it in the mail, and I know that the guy got the letter, opened it up, read it, picked up the phone, and called me in tears. He said, Denny, I am so sorry. I had no idea. I had no idea. I said, well, great. So he said at the end of that conversation, I'm going to make this right. He said, how did you live with that for 28 years? I said, well, not very gracefully, you know. So guess what? I made a record before that band that I was with this same guy, and that's being reissued right now, 41 years later. So I'm in it again. I'm in it again. But I'm in it a different way this time. I'm in it a different way. I've got God on my side. That's what I learned around here, that all I have to do is just bunch all my problems up and hand them off to him and let him alone. Let him handle my problems. I do a terrible job of it. He does a great job with it. So I'm not healed, but I'm a whole lot better than I am. I'm going to do a lot better than I did the first time. It ain't going to take me 28 years to get over this one. And in memory of Dr. Bob, in memory of those two guys, too, how about Bill Wilson and Bob Smith? I mean, I just love it that we're a fellowship. You know, Bill Wilson was a pretty shifty character. He was a great, great guy, almost a con artist. And Dr. Bob was a proctologist that used to have to drink a beer before going up your butt in the morning, you know. How great is it that we're all alive and well because of these two guys, you know? It's perfect for Alcoholics Anonymous. But no, in honor of Dr. Paul used to end his pitches with, you know, alcoholism is the only disease known to mankind. When you catch it, you become a better person. How true is that? And all we have to do is to keep it is to give it away. And all it insists of us, it insists that we be happy, joyous, and free. Now, that was hard for me to figure out over the years, but I've come to grips with that one, too. Happy, joyous, and free is a pretty simple equation. A life happy, joyous, and free is a life free of resentments, fears, and unsolvable sexual problems. It's that damn four steps. So if you haven't had a chance to build your archway through which you pass a free man, get one of these old-timers to explain it to you. Thanks so much for listening.
This recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.